for me, it's the first time we are in presence, and I've been here for a year and 3 months. So it's very nice to be back to in-presence events like this. And as you know, this is a series that we develop with policymakers that have the experience in the ground to tell you more a bit about what they do, how they do it, challenges they faced. In the case of today, we have the pleasure of welcoming Dimitri Demekas, who comes from a 30-year-long career at the IMF. He's currently a consultant. He advises, for instance, the Bank of England. He has been involved in the G20. He is also involved in a series of research and other publications and advice. He is, of course, a visiting senior fellow at the LSE. And today we're going to be listening about financial regulation, climate change, and the transition to a low carbon economy. So talking about complex, timely, interesting topics that policymakers are going to be faced with. Please help me in welcoming Dimitri Demekas with us today. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Professor Rivakis and I thank you for hope I will live up to the expectations you created. If anybody cannot hear me, please let me know so I can move this, do that, and it should be okay, including the people online. So today we'll talk about financial regulation and breaking climate considerations in it. We'll talk about three broad questions. One is, what are central banks and financial regulators doing actually today in terms of bringing climate considerations in financial regulation? What the experience has been, what have we learned, what are the challenges that we have met? Second, we'll talk a bit about the question whether they should be doing what they're doing, or whether they should be doing something completely different, because there have been a number of critics that have argued that what they're doing is a bit of a waste of time. Instead, they should be having a totally different focus than what they're doing so far. And we'll go through the arguments for and against. Welcome. And then, because every policy intervention does not only have the benefit effect, but also has risks, economic risks, but also political risks, and unintended consequences. So we'll talk about some of those in the case of climate and financial regulation. Now, this is a policy practice seminar, so I'm going to be taking squarely the regulators, the policymakers' perspective in this. There will be need for some short digressions into background, so we make sure we all talk about the same things, we understand what we're talking about. But I will be telling you about how things look from the regulators' point of view. What are their concerns? What are their preoccupations? What are the challenges and the risks as they see them? I should warn you, though, that at the end of this, you may be frustrated because you may not get clear answers to any of these questions. And this is partly because this is all very recent. So this is an area that is rapidly evolving, and maybe in 2 years' time, it will look different than it looks today. But mostly because these questions are genuinely hard questions, and they do not admit to easy answers. So what I hope to be able to do, though, is to give you like a fly on the wall view of the debates that take place inside central banks, inside financial policy committees, inside the governing board of regulatory agencies, and try to understand how these things look from their perspective. And then you can make up your own mind as to whether we should be doing this or something else. Before we start, it would be useful to remind ourselves what regulation is and how it's organized. So it's that the broad objectives of financial regulation are to ensure what we call the safety and soundness of individual financial institutions, be it banks or insurance companies, asset managers, pension funds, whatever institutions we regulate. And the other one is to make sure that the financial system as a whole can continue functioning and serving the real economy even under stress. Up to the time of the financial crisis, we thought these two things were completely overlapping, but if we ensured one, the other one would fall in place by itself. We now know this is not the case, so we have a slightly separate set of tools called microprudential tools to pursue, to ensure the safety and soundness of individual institutions, and macroprudential tools to ensure financial stability. Of course, individual regulatory agencies have additional objectives like preserving market efficiency, protecting the consumers of financial services, depositors, investors, or fighting financial crimes. But these additional objectives have to be seen into the framework provided by the two overarching goals. Now, in almost basically in every country these days, financial regulation is typically delegated to one or more independent agencies, typically the central bank. But here in the UK, you also have the Financial Conduct Authority. In many countries, you have Securities and Exchange Commissions. In some countries, you have separate agencies of insurance supervision. And I put independent in quotation marks because these agencies are not really independent. After all, they're creatures of the state and they pursue public policy objectives, right? But they enjoy a significant amount of operational independence in the context of their day-to-day business, as well as some degree of budgetary independence. And the reason why we've done it this way is because we have decided that the goals of financial are best served by agencies that are as far removed as possible from the political business cycle, from the electoral cycle. So that's the underlying idea. And there's a whole bunch of why that is. Of course, independence comes with accountability, so there are specific accountability mechanisms. That's why you have central bank governors appearing in front of parliament, so here in the UK and the Treasury Select Committee, need to give account of how they pursue these objectives and how they use the public resources that are made available to them. And also for that reason, regulatory agencies cannot do whatever they feel like and cannot, should not do whatever the government tells them to do. So their mandates, their goals, and in many cases, even the tools that they're allowed to use are established in law. If we want them to do something else, we're going to have to change the law. And one last element, an aspect of this that is often misunderstood is the importance of what can be called transnational regulatory networks, things like the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, the International Organization of Securities Commissions, the International Organization Association of Insurance Supervisors, the Financial Stability Board. These are associations of national supervisory authorities, and they have one very important role, which is to negotiate, agree on, and establish global standards, common approaches to the supervision of their respective sectors. And the reason for that is finance is a globalized business. So if any jurisdiction, every country did whatever they wanted, then of course the concern would be that financial companies would gravitate towards the jurisdictions with the most lax regulatory standards. So to prevent this, and to make sure that if a bank is operating in 20 countries, does not have to deal with 20 completely different approaches, completely different philosophies of supervision, these transnational networks establish these common standards. And although these standards are not legally binding, national supervisory authorities take them very, very seriously, and they hesitate a lot before making anything that would be seen as a departure from the standards. And each and every one of these elements will become relevant in the discussion going forward. So the other thing to keep in mind, of course, as I mentioned earlier, is that climate is a relatively recent preoccupation of financial regulators. It was only in about 2000-2001 that you had the first reports, and they came from the industry itself, specifically the insurance industry, about the potential risks that climate could cause to their business. And in the same year, you also had the first IPCC report that focused on the economic aspects of climate change, not financial, but more broadly economic aspects, as well as the first report by the Finance Initiative of the United Nations Environment Program. At the same time, since about the late 90s, you had an increasing interest of investors and shareholders in environmental sustainability and governance issues, in social and governance issues, ESG issues, which became more and more prominent in annual shareholders meetings and governing boards of both financial and non-financial firms. Again, this is all happening in the private sector so far. But it was not until the politicians had their say that the regulators responded. So in 2015, you had, of course, the Paris Agreement. You had the G20 call to the Financial Stability Board, one of the transnational networks we spoke about a minute ago, to see how finance can take into account climate issues. And it was only after this that you had the first speeches by major central bank governors about financial risks from climate, the first regulatory attempts to capture these risks for insurance companies, again, because that's where the other half is most pronounced. And not until 2020-21 that you had the first kind of attempts to capture this risk for banking. So when we discuss what the experience has been so far, and when you sort of evaluate and judge this experience, keep in mind it's extremely recent. Okay. But one way or another, there is a work program that emerged over time, and that has basically two elements, two aspects. One is efforts, attempts to analyze climate-related risk. And the other one, on that basis, to see what, if any, changes in regulations are needed to help mitigate them. And we're going to talk about each of them separately for a few minutes and see what has happened so far. So let's start with the analysis of climate-related risks. Now, when regulators are faced with something called risk, our reaction is, well, we know how to do this. We have a tool that we have developed and, in fact, perfected since the crisis called stress test. So let's try to do a stress test for climate risk. Climate risk comes in two flavors, right? There's physical risk. That's simply the impact of climate change on financial business. So, for example, we know that climate change will cause rising sea levels. Rising sea levels will have an impact, physical impact, in places like the Netherlands or the Southeast. People that have homes there or businesses that have factories there will be affected. Banks that have lent to these owners or to these businesses or insurance companies that have extended protection will face losses, physical risk. The other one, the transition risk, is the impact not of climate change, but of climate mitigation policies on financial risk. So a typical example there is, suppose tomorrow, governments decide to jack up carbon prices suddenly by a lot. Mining companies, companies that sit on a lot of fossil fuels, will find out suddenly that these assets are not as valuable. Pension funds or asset managers who hold shares in these companies will realize losses. That's a transition risk. Now, transition risk, as you notice, can arise for very good reasons as a result of generally desirable ones, but still, from a regulatory perspective, it's a risk, right? So, in the last 3 years, we have been trying to stress test for that risk. But before I tell you what we discovered, we need to make one of those little digressions to make sure we understand what a stress test is. So, here goes a 3-minute crash course on stress testing. So, what is a stress test? A stress test starts with a baseline macroeconomic projection for the next 3 or 5 years, or however many years is covered by the scenario, right? On which we superimpose a fairly detailed quantified stress scenario for whatever it is the risk that we want to evaluate. A lot of people think that stress test tells you what the risks are. It's like a crystal ball. You look and they tell you what the problems could be. But this could be not, it could not be furthest from the truth. Stress test, take your stress assumption as an input. You need to know what the risk you're worried about is. And if you put it in there, what the stress test does is tell you what the possible impact is. Then we can also build in bells and whistles. We can model second round effects and feedback loops to the real economy. And then we take all this and we put it into the stress testing model, which is actually a very simple machine. It could even be Excel spreadsheet in quite often it is. And that has also some very important components. First of all, we impose very strict constraints on the behavior of the firms that participate in the test. Banks or insurance companies. Right? So assume, for example, that if there is this shock that we are modeling for, these firms will not be able to adjust immediately their business models. They will not be able to find suddenly new profitable clients to compensate for the losses from the stress test. We also assume that policymakers will not adjust policies immediately and effectively to compensate for the losses that financial firms will make or to recapitalize them if necessary. And the reason why we make these assumptions is not because they're realistic. They're, of course, unrealistic. Businesses will always try to adjust, and policymakers will respond. They respond late, and they respond unsuccessfully, but they will respond. But you see, if we bake these adjustments into the cake, what kind of, there is no cake at the end. The stress goes away. So we deliberately assume that there will be no adjustments because we want to see the maximum impact this scenario could have on the firms we are including in the test. We also rely heavily on historical data because that's how we simulate, that's how we calculate the impact of the shock. So if, for example, let's say the stress scenario is 25% increase in average real estate values in the greater London area in the next 3 quarters. That's kind of a typical stress scenario, right? So if we want to calculate the impact on bank balance sheets for insurance companies, we look in the past. Do I press something for So we look at similar shocks in the past, and we use those parameters to estimate the impact on the balance sheets. So historical data, critical input in stress test. So we put all this in the machine, we shake, or most likely just press F9, and out come the estimated losses for financial firms that participate. And these typically are expressed in terms of the capital that are required to set aside, right? And the outcome could be that under the stress scenario, the losses are small and would not have a major impact on their capital, or that they would be significant and their total capital would fall below regulatory minima. And in that case, the banks or insurance companies would have to add more capital to remain in compliance with regulations. Or in extreme cases, that the losses are so severe that their capital is wiped out, the firms become insolvent, and they have to be closed, resolved, recapitalized, whatever. So then we go to the central bank governor or the regulator and we say, okay, here's the results. And then they have to decide what the policy response is. And the policy response could be, we do nothing, we declare the system resilient because the impact in that hypothetical scenario is small, or we want banks to put up additional capital today. We want them to respond preemptively so that they could be resilient to the shock if the shock were to arrive. So this is the kind of, this is what we do. Every stress test does this, right? The details could differ. The test can be run by the central bank in-house. It could be run by the banks separately, and then the central bank integrates the results. But every stress test looks like this. So when we try to run climate-related risks through this machine, we came up to a number of problems. The first one is, although we call it climate-related risk, climate pathways, climate events, are not really like every other kind of risk to which we can assign a particular probability. They are subject to radical uncertainty, what economists call Knightian uncertainty, from Frank Knight, an economist who analyzed the difference between risk and uncertainty in the 30s. And so it is very hard to assign probabilities to specific climate events. So we know, for example, that sea levels will rise in the next 80 years, unless we do X, Y, and Z according to the Paris Agreement. But we cannot tell what is the probability that they will rise by 28 centimeters in the next 15 years and by another 12 centimeters in the following 12 years. And it is not because we are not smart enough, it is because these are not genuinely knowable things. So this is what radical uncertainty means. Which of course means that it's very, very hard to formulate a stress scenario in the degree of detail that is needed to put into that machine. The second problem we came across is that climate risk is unprecedented, right? There's no historical data. It's very difficult to find similar shocks to look at what has happened and use those data to simulate the impact. And the third, perhaps the most important problem is that typical stress test goes out 3, maybe 5 years. Climate risk will manifest itself over 30 or 50 years or even longer. And that very long time horizon means, of course, that these constraints we impose, the borderline plausible are completely implausible, totally unrealistic. Somebody needs to mute?
Yes.
So it could be a crying baby or a barking dog. So, it could be so over 30 or 50 years, you know, businesses will adjust. In fact, businesses will close down and new businesses will emerge. Technology will change. And policymakers, no matter how feckless they are, they will actually do something about the shock. And so these restrictions become, the whole exercise becomes very contrived if we try to use the stress testing tools we have. So, you know, when faced with problems like this, of course, economists do what economists always do, to make assumptions. So we said, okay, fine, well, let's forget getting a particular precise point estimate of the losses. Let's try instead to come up with a plausible range of estimates. You know, we don't know exactly how much, fine, but we would know approximately how much. Unfortunately, in every single stress test exercise that has been conducted so far, the range of estimated losses is way too wide. The Dutch Central Bank did one of the first stress tests focusing on banks and focusing on physical risk. Transition risk is more difficult to model. And that was in 2019. And their finding, and I may be getting the decimals wrong here, but their finding was that the estimated losses would range between 3.8% of bank capital to 29.9% of bank capital. In other words, from negligible, really, to very, very severe. And I mean, from a sort of scientific perspective, this is fine. This is the best we can do, right? But if you are a policymaker and then somebody brings you these results and say, well, what, governor, what are we going to do? It is extremely difficult to do anything today to take into account this kind of range of losses over such a long time. So this is what we have learned so far. Again, I want to remind you, this is only 2 or 3 years, and the stress testing technology and modeling is changing all the time. If we were to have this discussion 2 years from now, it might look different. But this is what we've seen so far. So let's forget this and let's ask ourselves, as the regulators have, all right, but forget that for a moment. If we were to adjust a regulatory framework, we took climate into account, how could we do? What are the tools that we could possibly use, right? So one proposal that has gained a lot of traction, particularly in the EU, in fact, 2017-18, the vice president of the commission was giving speeches saying this is what we plan to do, is to introduce green supporting factors and brown penalizing factors in risk weights. So digression number two, what does that mean? Okay. So banks, because we're talking about banks, right? Banks are regulated in line with the Basel Capital Framework. The Basel Framework, we're now in Basel III, the third version of that framework, was negotiated by a transnational regulatory network called the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. And it says that the required capital, the capital that banks are required to set aside to manage unforeseen, unpredictable risks, is calculated by looking at every single loan, every single asset on the bank balance sheet, multiplying it by a risk factor that is determined according to the regulation, according to the Basel framework. It is higher for risky loans, so loans that have a longer maturity or have less value or collateral or whatever, and it is lower for less risky loans. Then you add all this up, and that is the required capital. And obviously, banks that are very aggressive and that they grow high risks, they are required to put aside more capital. Banks that are more conservative, they're required to set aside less capital. So the idea is, well, let's look at this with a look that can take these risk weights and let's lower them for loans to green transition supporting investments, to green companies, and increase them slightly, tweak these risk rates to penalize loans to brown projects. That sounds like an obvious idea. The idea there is by changing this, you change the relative cost of this project. Obviously, the more capital you require to set aside, the more expensive the operation becomes. And so we would make green loans, green assets, slightly cheaper from a regulatory perspective and the other ones slightly more expensive. And that would help redirect financial flows to where we want them to go. But the more we started looking into this, the problems started coming up. The first one was, we have seen no evidence so far, and again, I say so far, that green loans are less risky than brown loans. There is no empirical evidence to suggest this. They seem to be equally likely to default as brown loans that are comparable, of course, the same duration, the same collateral, etc. So from a purely Basel perspective, there seems to be no argument for differentiating between them. The second one is that there is no evidence that tweaking the risk weights actually would have a major impact on loan allocation, on financial flows. In 2014 or 15, the European Union introduced, tweaked with the risk weights to encourage loans to small and medium enterprises. SMEs, as you know, the world over, have greater difficulty in attracting bank lending than large companies, right? So the UK came up with this great idea that it would introduce an SME supporting factor into risk weights, we will lower the cost of a loan to an SME, so banks will lend more to SMEs. And a few years later, the European Banking Authority came back and looked at the data and concluded that there was no visible impact of the SME supporting factor into SME lending, adjusting for everything else, of course, that determines loan flows. So, and then some French researchers last year, the reference, by the way, I wrote in the paper that I think you have been given a link to. Came at this question from a slightly different angle. They asked themselves, okay, so let's, if a green supporting factor were to have a perceptible impact, how big would it need to be? So this is not an actual evidence, this is a simulation. and they did the simulation, and they came up with a conclusion: for a green supporting factor to have a perceptible, measurable impact on green lending, it would have to be something of the order of 50%. You would need to halve risk weights to have a big impact. So it seems that the capital framework we have created is quite good in reducing risk, in forcing capitals to set banks to set capital aside for higher risk loans. It is not so effective in redirecting financial flows from one sector to the other. And so, against this background, regulators have so far been understandably cautious. They have not, I'm not aware of any major central bank that has introduced a green supporting factor. Instead, what they've done is they've issued guidance with the supervisory expectations. And this is basically, it's quite important, this step, but it's a set of instructions to the supervised entities, insurance companies or banks or whatever, saying we expect you to take climate risk into account, and this is what we expect to see. This is how we expect to see that you do it. Supervisory expectations are not unimportant, but of course they're not quantifiable, right? They're qualitative guidance, is not quantitative requirements, and they fall far short of the regulatory action that some people have envisaged. So this is what we have learned so far, again, so far, in trying to assess climate risk and in trying to consider what tools we could use to mitigate. And then a number of people said, look, this is all kind of silly, really, and they questioned the whole approach. And they said, instead of central banks and regulators obsessively focusing on risk, instead what they should do is abandon this focus and play a more active promotional role to encourage climate transition. So they should use all tools at their disposal to ensure that financial flows go to the right place. They should do things like direct bank lending to certain sectors. They should perhaps ban lending to other sectors. They should require all supervised companies to have green transition or net zero transition plans. They should audit them on the implementation of these plans. In other words, they should do things that regulators have never done, things that are well outside the traditional mandate of regulators. And as far as I can tell, there are two arguments that we propose in favor of this big change. The first one basically says, look, obsessively focusing on risk is a waste of time, right? Climate pathways, climate events are subject to radical uncertainty. If you keep trying to measure them, you will fail and you will waste time. And so from this perspective, from the perspective of this argument, regulators focusing on the traditional mandates and trying to measure risk is like a band playing on the Titanic while the world burns. I mean, literally people have compared them to this. So that's one argument. The other argument is slightly different. It says, look, we know that the first best policy for climate mitigation is fiscal policy. From an economic perspective, climate impact can be seen as a market failure. The market for greenhouse gas emissions does not price those properly. There's an externality, right? So we know what to do with those. We increase, we get the carbon pricing right through carbon taxes or emission trading schemes or whatever. And once that happens, the market will take care. The market will adjust and take care of the problem. But unfortunately, politicians don't seem to be able to get carbon pricing right, or at least not fast enough. So let's use other tools, and in this case, financial regulation tools, to make sure that finance flows where it's supposed to flow. And this is expressed in this excerpt. And unfortunately, for those who are economically trained here, this excerpt talks about the second best, you know, it's first best, second best policies, which shows a complete and fundamental misunderstanding of the Lipsky-Lancaster second best theorem. But forget the second best term. I mean, what are they from sort of plain English common sense point of view? Look, we have a set of policy tools that we know will work. These are not available. Let's look at other policy tools. Forget the second best. Well, you know, when that debate started, so as you could imagine, some objections started being raised. Some of them are more persuasive than others. The first one, came from central bankers and looking forward to do this, it should violate market neutrality. Market neutrality is a long-standing principle in central banking. It basically says any policy intervention we make should not discriminate between different asset classes and different instruments. It should affect all the financial markets as neutrally as possible. Obviously, if we start discriminating green versus brown assets, we would violate that principle of market neutrality. have long kind of long-standing principles. But at least from my point of view, this doesn't have a lot of muster. If you start from the assumption, the agreement, that what we see is due to a market failure, right? It's kind of hard to be obsessed about being neutral with respect to that market. We need to get in and correct the market failures. As a result, a number of central bankers, Christine Lagarde gave a number of speeches, have started questioning the principle there, the principle of market neutrality when it comes to climate issues. So that was one objection. The other one said, people noticed that if we ask what we expect a central bank start playing a more active promotional role, well, this would be incompatible with their current legal mandates, as you recall from the beginning, right? What central banks are supposed to do and regulators are supposed to do is established in law. So they cannot start doing something else just because they feel like it, or because some academics like Blanc saying that it would be a good idea, we have to go and change the law. And that is true. I mean, there is some debate about primary and secondary mandates, but I think broadly speaking, that objection is valid. But again, if you take a longer historical perspective, central banks and regulatory mandates are not eternally mutable, right? If we want them to do something else, we go in and change the law. After the financial crisis in many countries, we change the legal mandates. We even change completely the financial regulatory architecture. So if we as a society decide that we want them to do this, nothing stops us from changing the law and changing their mandates. There is an important catch there. It is not the central bankers themselves should not start doing something else by themselves, right? Or because the press writes about it. There is a process to be gone through. This should be mediated by the political process. We have to go to parliament, we have to debate it, change the law, and then also introduce the appropriate accountability arrangement. So we'll make sure that whatever we want them to do, they actually go out and do it. But if we all are willing to go through this process, there is nothing magic about the current mandates. They can be changed. The third objection is kind of perhaps more serious. Central bankers and supervisors are given a certain set of tools, which as it turns out are quite good for some things. But if we ask them to pursue different objectives with the same tools, inevitably conflicts will arise. This is what economists call the Tinbergen problem, from the name of a Dutch economist who talked about the correspondence of policy goals and policy tools back in the 50s. And we saw an example of this earlier when we talked about the green supporting factor, right? Because green loans are not less risky than brown loans. If we introduce such a green supporting factor in order to encourage financial flows in that sector, even if we thought it would be effective, it would go against the principal objective for which we have risk weight, which is to preserve the risk. In fact, what would be resulting in the banking system taking more risk than we would want. So this is an example of how using the same tool for two objectives can lead to conflicts. And this is expressed in this excerpt by Lillian Boot, a very well-known respected economist, who said, look, you don't use carbon taxes to ensure financial stability, and you want to use the right tool for the right policy. And then the last objection is something that we've discussed already, that the tools that we have, the tools that central bankers and regulators have, are quite effective for the goals that we have given them, but are likely to be not very effective for these other goals. And so regulators have started looking into this, and the Bank of England, in a paper that we published literally a couple of months in November, I think, asked exactly that question. And their conclusion was that the capital framework, and more broadly, if you want, regulatory tools, should be used to address the consequences of climate change in terms of increased risk for financial institutions, rather than the causes of climate change. So this is the latest on this debate. I don't think this debate is over by any means, but this is where the arguments for and against are. So let's move on to the last bit. As I said, every policy intervention does not only have the intended effect, but it also has risks. And if you're a policymaker and you contemplate certain policy action or regulatory change, context is everything. You worry about the context, whether it's the financial context, the economic, or the political context. So let's look at a couple of aspects of the current context that are relevant, and they're very, very high up on the minds of regulators. The first one is what people call a green bubble. So These two charts come from a recent edition of The Economist magazine, and they track stock prices of green companies in a number of sectors. The classification is The Economist's classification, right? And people have noticed that what we see with these stock prices looks very, very similar to what we saw with dot-com companies in 1999-2000, and also what we saw with mortgage-backed securities in 2005-2006. Different context, different financial instruments, same patterns, same market dynamics. And this excerpt comes from an article in the Financial Times last week, actually. Some of the contributing factors behind these models seem to be exactly the same. So we're looking at something that looks scaringly familiar, right? Now, this is not the creation or the responsibility of financial supervisors or central bankers. And arguably, central banks and financial supervisory authorities are not there to prevent bubbles. Financial bubbles are part of the parcel of financial markets. They've always been with us, they always will. They come and they go, they affect different sectors. So it's not their responsibility to prevent them from arising. And arguably they could not even if they wanted. But if you're a central bank or a regulator, and you see that they're contemplating climate-related action, you'd be very, very cautious before you do anything that could be seen as feeding this bubble further. No? Because it's not only your reputation that you worry about, which you do a lot, but it's also that if that bubble were to grow, and then burst, it would actually have real implications. And it would actually harm the transition that you're trying to engineer. If these companies go massively bankrupt, then financial flows into green technology, green investments would stop for at least a year or two. This is exactly what we started talking about. So it's not that you should prevent this bubble from arising, but you really don't want to be seen as contributing to it. Another very important element of the context that I can assure you people are talking about every day now is what people have termed greenflation. So what's happening now in Europe, North America, and the UK, so we're withdrawing traditional sources of energy generation faster than we are introducing alternative sources of energy generation. So, not surprising, the energy prices go up. And here is the ECB board member saying, you know what, this is not a one-off. It's not something that happened last October by accident. This is something that will continue for many years to come. Now, you're a central banker. Your primary objective is fighting inflation. You will be holding from the parliament if you fail that objective. I bet you will think twice before doing anything that seems to be in conflict with our primary objective. So this is what some, and there's more, but this is some of the context that is relevant in some policy makers' minds when they contemplate doing something about climate. And then they also think of other risks. One of them is that if they start taking action that is outside their mandates, they would be accused of mission creep. This is what happened after the global financial crisis. They started being active in the area of financial stability, right? And people said, well, hang on, your job is to fight inflation and to ensure safety and soundness. And you cannot go on doing other things, even though in that case they were closely related. So they're very sensitive to the accusation of mission creep, partly because, again, they care about reputations, but partly because if they were to do something like this, there would be calls for greater accountability. And that would be equivalent to a loss of their very valued independence. So they would be very hesitant to do anything that might result in a cause of any loss of independence. But then perhaps the biggest risk, and of course, at this point, I stop working, is the lack of policy coordination. The lack of coordination without policy. So imagine a scenario where the government announces that it will increase carbon taxes over a period of time and asks central banks to do their bit. Central banks take measures to encourage financial flows into investments. You are a pension fund. And so prompted by regulators or in anticipation of regulatory action, you shift your investments to green sectors. But then, surprisingly, the government does not implement the carbon tax increases they promised to do. What happens? You're sitting on the wrong investments. And again, it's not like your profit is slightly less. You can live with that. You have failed your fiduciary duty to the pensioners you're supposed to serve. There are legal implications for it. So this is a contrived scenario. It's an artificial scenario. tells you something about how these people think and how regulators think. Because if that were to happen, of course, the blame would fall on the regulators who asked them to do this. So we talked about what regulators are doing or have been doing. We talked about the debate, whether they should be doing something completely different, what are the arguments for and against. And I've talked to you about some of the considerations, some of the risks that they worry them, some of the risks that worry the regulators and they go through their minds. Where does that leave us? One of the biggest concerns the regulators have is getting caught as the only game in town. You don't remember, but people have known that Ben Bernanke, then governor of the Fed after the financial crisis, had said, the Fed is the only game in town in preventing the recession turning into a depression, because monetary policy was the only tool they had, right? And as a famous central banker at the time, Irving King, then governor of the Bank of England, said, if central banks are the only game in town, we don't like this. They hate to be the only ones holding the stick. And so again, they will wait to see what governments plan to do and how they deliver on their Paris Agreement promises before moving. Now, you know, there is, if there was one thing I would wish you would do, if there was homework I would assign, is I would ask you to go away and go home and we'll go to the pub or whatever. And then imagine that you are a central bank governor. Imagine that you're a member of the Financial Policy Committee. You sit there and some colleague of you on the Financial Policy Committee start making arguments. How would you respond? What other considerations do you bring to the table? Do you need to decide whether to do X or Y? How would you respond? Imagine you're a central bank governor, an aggressive journalist or an NGO, or write up in the press says, why aren't you doing more about climate? What would you say to them on the spot? And this is a useful exercise, I think, because you know, it will, I hope, teach you the one thing that I hope you get out of this seminar. And that is that, you know, complex real world policy questions don't have easy answers. Anybody who tells you, or read my latest blog, the answer is easy, this is what they should do, are probably wrong. If there's one thing I want you to take away from this, is this. Thanks very much. I'll stop here. I hope I didn't take too much time and we can open the floor.
Thank you so much, Dimitri, for a fascinating presentation with lots of elements to it, very complex indeed, and one that is basically in the core of the debate of finance, financial regulation, stability and the future of the global economy as a whole. I will take my opportunity to make some comments and basically two questions, and then we'll open for the students here and the students that are remotely. One thing that I've seen in the students, first of all, is a huge interest in this topic and a huge interest in particular in ESGs. Mm-hmm. But one challenge that I think we all see is the lack of a single series of best practices and standards on this, mm-hmm. No? There's a huge variety of measurements, there's a huge variety of auditors, there's a huge variety of actors involved, of thresholds, and that's something that we have discussed in many of the classes. You were talking about the lack of policy coordination and the lack of perhaps coherence in terms of this regime. So what is your advice in terms of someone that is interested in engaging more in the ESG framework and in the ESG architecture as to where to start and where to find places to get more involved and to perhaps pursue a career in that regard? And my second question is more in relation to the Green FinTech Challenge. Mm-hmm. There's here in the UK, you're advising the Bank of England, this sandbox on this topic in particular. Can credit and investment in the context of FinTech portfolios be something that is, you know, that is worth seeking in the future, in, you know, creating incentives for that in the future? How is the regulatory aspects of that industry in particular you know, being seen at a, as you know, for instance, the banks have made this commitment for reducing emissions by 2015, this traditional banking initiative. And you spoke about two elements in relation to regulation, traditional regulation and risk assessment. But for that, you need, in the first place, historic data that you mentioned, and the other is perhaps more centralized data. And this is exactly the opposite to fintech, no? The opposite to fintech, meaning that they don't have perhaps the, you know, the long track record that many of the traditional finance industry has, and they are by design decentralized. So how do you see these two elements playing around? And then we will open the floor for the students.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let me start from the second question, because I think it's a more difficult one and I have less to say. So it's always good to it's true that many central banks, including the Bank of England, has a sandbox, which basically what it is, you know what that is. Basically, it's a space with lighter regulations, easier regulations, that is supposed to be a space for smaller emerging companies, fintech companies to play. And then when they grow enough and establish themselves, of course, they will be regulated more. So there is that. And there is, of course, a lot of interest in combining fintech and green, partly because they're both very trendy, partly because, you know, technology can benefit both. So in answer to your question, the first aspect of it, is this a good thing? It's absolutely a good thing. Of course, technological progress can be encouraged. A sandbox can be a good place to try technologies, including combining green and fintech aspects, elements, to bring about some improvement. But both in finance and in sort of the broader climate area, you know, the answer may often not be new fancy technologies. The answer may be sometimes staring us in the face. As you know, in the EU, there is a big debate as to whether nuclear would be an answer. This is nothing to do with finance. And, you know, many people argue, and I personally agree, that this could be an answer to the problem, right? This is not a new technology. So while we should encourage and expect more from the combination of fintech and climate, and green, I don't think we should limit ourselves to necessarily new ideas that nobody has thought about before. I think we should also have a more open mind about where the answers could be. As regards the centralized versus decentralized data, I think, you know, data is a complex issue. There are several aspects to it, both in terms of control, disclosure, and of course, you know, protection of privacy. But unless I'm missing something in your question, I don't really see necessarily a conflict or a tension between, you know, technologies using or decentralizing the use of data and the need to collect and use a lot more data for a sound supervisory policy. Because decentralized data does not mean that they need to remain unknown, right? Because you can impose disclosure requirements on this data, regardless of who collects them, and then be able to use them as a supervisor. So again, maybe I've missed something, or maybe I'm looking at it very superficially, but I don't really see a tension between these two. On your other question on ESG classifications, that indeed is it's actually an embarrassment of the riches. As a result of the investor and shareholder interest in ESG issues that I talked about earlier, you've had a proliferation of standards. The International Organization of Securities Commissions counted them like in 2 years ago, and there's a reference in my paper as well. Apparently, there's 50 different standards, ESG standards. And of course, they are overlapping, they're inconsistent. All of them are promoted by private sector initiatives, some NGOs, some global institutions, some private ESG advisors who see them as a sort of good business opportunity. And there has been more and more concern about the governance of those standards. Who promulgates them? Who assesses that whatever assessment is made is consistent and it is consistent across firms? And there have been many instances of firms being assessed by different advisors against the same standard, different advisors, and getting two completely different ratings. I've been following this sector for 2-3 years now, and I haven't seen so many articles about greenwashing, which is exactly what I'm talking about, right? As I have in the last 2 or 3 months. So there is clearly a big problem there. And of course, what people do in these circumstances, they say the state should do something about it. So why can't you come in and impose uniform, similar, and obligatory, statutory taxonomy that would solve all these problems and eliminate the sort of pesky various standards from the private sector? So that's, again, as we saw in other cases, this sounds in many ways like the obvious solution. And there are two major jurisdictions that I'm aware of that have imposed a statutory standard. This is statutory taxonomy for classifying every economic activity and an asset, right? And these two jurisdictions are the EU and China. I don't know if that tells you something, but anyhow, these are the only two. And again, the experience has not been as clear-cut success as we would have liked it to be. In the case of the EU, for example, you have seen a lot of debate about whether some industries or sectors or some technology should be either classified this way or that way. There have also been concerns that these taxonomies are static and backward-looking, as of course they have to be. Anything you pass in law or regulation looks at this, so freezes time and looks at how things are now. But if you think about it, what you would like to see is existing polluting technologies or production functions transitioning into more green or more sustainable technologies. Statutory obligatory taxonomies don't do this. They don't have space for this. Unless you change the classification, unless you revise your taxonomy, if something is brown today, it will be brown tomorrow. So if you have a company that wants to, a polluting company, a fossil fuel producer, who wants to invest in carbon capture, they will not find it easy to do under the current taxonomy. The other thing we've seen is that they like old-fashioned industrial policies from the 50s and 60s, which ultimately they look a little bit like industrial policies, right? They are subject to the same lobbying by industry and the same political considerations. You may agree or disagree whether nuclear energy should be green or not, which is a big debate, as you've seen in the press in the EU. There are different opinions on this, but there is no doubt that it was decided that it was the way it was, partly because of lobbying by the industry and political considerations. So clearly these influences are there. So statutory taxonomies, although they may look very appealing for people who are frustrated by this proliferation, may not necessarily be the answer. And if it is, it may not be a sort of clean cut answer that we can all sort of do it and then go home and sleep quiet. Does that address
it? Yeah, absolutely. Just the perhaps the precision on the first part was that basically you can say that the traditional financial sector is fully regulated, whereas the fintech industry is partly regulated. There's many vacuums and loopholes, no? That's what I was referring to.
The other problem with really is with statutory taxonomies is you see that is a harder problem to address, is that they do not cover everything. So they apply to publicly traded companies and assets, publicly traded stocks and bonds and stuff. But they do not constrain private equity from anything. So if you're a big family fund and you see banks withdrawing from fossil fuel producers, nothing stops you. In fact, what we have seen in the last few years, according to some accounts, because we don't have complete data, is polluting activities and companies shifting their financing from the regulated financial sector to private equity. So you may sort of spend all your time in taxonomies and making mandatory disclosure requirements and statutory taxonomies. And at the end, it's like squeezing a balloon. You squeeze here, it pops out somewhere else. So you need to take all these things into account.
Thank you. Thank you, Dimitri. Okay. Please. The floor is open.
Yeah. I do have a question about, you mentioned this balance between the coordination between what governments are doing and what the regulators should be doing in order to move forward, right? And I wonder, would you give a hypothetical example with the...
Yeah.
I wonder in the real case of the Green New Deals around the world right now, the Biden Build Back Better agenda, or the Boris Build Back Better here, or the Polish Green New Deal, European Green New Deal, how are regulators reacting to those proposals in different countries in your mind? And if you, in your view, feel like this is going in the right direction or possibly not?
Mm-hmm. So I think the Green New Deals that you refer to involve mostly government flows government financing or other government investment or public-private partnership in some sectors. So it is not obvious that regulators need to respond immediately to that sort of thing, right? What I had in mind was different. What I had in mind was carbon taxes. So carbon taxes would penalize certain sectors and investment if they jack up significantly. And in that case, it would make sense for regulators to take that into account in their regulatory framework, because they would, as we saw, transition risk, right? They would involve higher risks for regulated firms. So in that case, there would be an argument for coordination of regulatory action and fiscal action. But in the case the government decides to invest in green companies or to provide subsidies for certain technologies, it is not immediately clear what the regulators could do, I think. At least I haven't thought deeply about this, but that's my probably initial reaction. Regulators could stand back and say, great, we think that's a great idea. We don't need to do anything about this. Best things happen. I don't know if it's a satisfactory answer, but I think this would be my gut reaction as sort of a central banker. Okay, great. Yeah.
So there's some quite innovative.
You can speak out of it.
Yeah. So there's quite innovative ideas around about financial regulation, and maybe, for example, the creation of a carbon coin. A carbon coin. That would kind of like finance green initiatives on a global scale. For example, that the central banks would be able to do QE to specifically finance green initiatives. Are there any, and this is quite futuristic and probably very improbable, but are there any ideas around expanding the mandates of central banks to such green initiatives and creating kind of like wholly new frameworks?
Yeah, so I think the short answer is no. Central banks, I think everywhere or most everywhere, are not involved in financing the real economy. Right? So the role of central banks vis-a-vis the real economy goes through the financial system. So I'm not aware of countries, I mean, in socialist countries and countries in the 50s, in some cases, central banks accepted direct credit. This practice has now stopped. So to my knowledge, there is no discussion of changing that. I think it's pretty fundamental at this point. The discussion is, how do we use the tools that we have vis-a-vis the financial system to indirectly encourage a shift in financial flows? And I think that's, we covered that in this discussion.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
Question regarding the taxonomy that you mentioned.
I'm sorry, you need to speak up, especially with the masks.
Yeah. So the taxonomy that you mentioned regarding the green bonds, especially the ESG debt, has been something published like 2 weeks ago, probably, right? So what's going to happen with all the debt that we already have, that it's either sustainable, social, green, transition, et cetera, et cetera? It's going to be a retroactive effect over that debt with this new taxonomy. And what's going to happen with the European companies that are under this taxonomy, and maybe they prefer to do this greenwashing, going to the US dollar market or other markets internationally?
So that's a good question, actually. I don't think that the taxonomies would be retroactive. So I don't think they would go and assess or grade debt that already has been issued. I think the taxonomies focus on activities and new issues. So if you're a company that has issued some debt before, it was neither green nor brown. It was what it was, right? But from now on, if you want to issue debt, then you need to get you need to disclose certain factors and get sort of a grade, or you know what they call under this taxonomy. So I don't think it would be retroactive. That said, if you're a company who is seen as polluting, or you are invested already in a technology that is seen as brown, that may have an impact on the secondary trading of your debt. Now that would not be a direct effect of the taxonomy on the debt itself. That would be rather an indirect market reaction to this. Okay.
Those of you online, do you have any question? Please stay.
So actually, before a question, first quick clarification. So with the stress testing that you said happened in 2019 onwards, was, as I understand it correct, that there's basically been very limited evidence that we can actually properly use because of the inputs that we're putting in so far. So we're not learning very much from the stress test. Is that correct?
Okay. So the question, let me just slightly rephrase it, if I may. So are you? So the question is, you told us about what you have learned from the stress testing exercises, and it doesn't look too promising. Are we wasting our time? Are they completely useless? And so the answer is no. I think where we're coming out is to understand that the stress tests for climate risk are of extremely limited use as guides for policy, for regulatory action today. So we cannot use them the way we use every other stress test we do, or at least so far we have not been able to. But that does not mean they're useless. They actually have, we, the Bank of England, believes, and many other central banks believe, that there is actually a benefit, even if it's a secondary benefit, because by asking banks to participate in, or insurance companies or financial firms to participate in this exercise, first of all, we'll raise awareness of these risks where it might not be. Second, we actually force them to look into risk factors, we force them to up their game, and we increase the quality of their own risk management, as well as our own understanding as supervisors of this type of risk. So it has a cumulative positive impact on risk management, but we have not been able so far to use it to take direct regulatory action. But then, no, it doesn't mean that they do. So at least we don't think that.
And so quick follow-up coming back to that. The immediacy of the climate crisis is obviously worse for some countries than it is for others. Do we have takeaways from specific countries that are doing it better than others in terms of financial regulation, specifically in this context? One, and two, if not traditional regulators as we have them, except if it's only the central bank in town, I'm out of town. Is there scope for other institutions to be either be set up or to take up that mantle where it's not the central banks going against the existing?
So on the first one, I think it's too early for takeaways. It is true that some central banks have done more than others. And the initiatives, particularly the area of stress testing and the debates about how we could use the capital framework, et cetera, are almost exclusively among central banks in Europe. The UK, the Fed is well behind this. I think they're watching and waiting. And very few others, the Hong Kong Monetary Authority has done something like this. The Bank of Japan is considering stress tests, but mostly this initiative has been in Europe. And I think that reflects the political reality that this debate is much more active in the environment in Europe, and regulators sort of feel compelled to do something about this, even if it is just to look at it and see what the risks are. I am pretty confident in saying that the takeaways we have gotten so far are basically what I summarized here, simply because the evidence is limited. Very few central banks have done a lot, and many of them have done very little. So it's too early for broad takeaways. But that said, both the Financial Stability Board and the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision are continuously looking into this, and something called, perhaps you've heard it, the Network for Greening the Financial System. So this is actually an interesting construct. It's not a regulatory network. It does not promulgate any global standards. It was an association of central banks, initially eight, that was created in 2017 at the initiative of the Bank of Hong Kong. And now it has, I think, 108 central banks and supervisory regions. And the idea there is to promote the exploration and the understanding of climate-related risks. Again, fully voluntary, nothing global standards there so far, right? Although that's changing. So they are doing a lot of work to see what the lessons are from what we've seen. I think they're going through pretty much the same ground that we went through here, of course, in a much better way. But as to the second question, if the central bank's regulators don't act, is there somebody else who could? And the answer is, of course, the governments, right? Look, climate change is an intensely political issue. It's political not because the politicians are involved. The politicians are involved because it's political meaning. It has significant and deep social, economic, distributional repercussions, generational repercussions. So it is not something that we should or could in good conscience assigned to bureaucrats, to independent unelected agencies, right? This is something that we have to deal through our political system, bad as it may be. That is the only transparent, accountable, democratic, if you want, way to deal with it. So if you want to use specifically financial regulation, if your question is, well, if the regulators don't change regulation, should we make another regulatory agency that will change regulation? That doesn't strike me as a particularly good idea. First, there's policy. First line of defense, and the last line of defense, really, is political action, is a government. So get them to do something. Yes?
Yeah, so I worked in prudential regulation for a little while, so I understand that I do quite well. So I was just thinking, I mean, why I understand like where you're coming from when you ask, should you know regulators even consider sort of the climate risks or, you know, and I feel banks inherently, intrinsically, will just have climate risk premiums in their PD models, and hence your pricing already sort of factors that in. So my question is really then, you know, because climate as a risk does not directly impact the bank itself. It has an impact on where the bank has lent money, and therefore there's that risk which is captured in the PD models already. So separately to capture them as a part of like pillar two or perhaps, you know, a higher RWA does not really make that much of sense to me. So I'm a bit conflicted. So should really central banks worry about climate risks and how they how banks capture this? Because as a bank,
I understand. It's a very good question. So the question is, for those who are not prudentially inclined, the question is, look, there is already a capital framework. It forces banks to take into account all risks, not just climate, for all risks, right? To the extent climate is a risk, you don't need to change regulations. What you need to do is to get them to do what they're supposed to do in the first place. And I think that's fair enough. The problem was, and the problem we are still facing, is that the banks are not very good at capturing that sort of risk because it's inherently difficult to measure. And if you want, this is the benefit of the stress testing exercises we do, is that sort of, it makes them more aware of these risks. And the benefit of the supervisory guidance and expectations that supervisors issue is not to say, do this, is to say, look, this is a risk that could potentially affect your balance sheet. Do something about it, consider this factor, that factor. And when I come to do the on-site, I want to see exactly what you've done, right? Yeah. No quantitative measures, no regulatory changes, but accountability. So I think the role the regulators have been playing so far through these regulatory expectations, through raising awareness and providing tools and analysis to the banks themselves or the insurance companies is useful. Is it world-changing? No. The debate that is more difficult is, should they stop there or should they do more? Should they go beyond risk? And I think we've been through that debate. Now, another way to ask this question, I don't know if that was in the back of your mind, is that, look, commercial banks, finance companies are already under a lot of pressure from their shareholders to do something about climate, right? So, there are active shareholders, there are NGOs, there's the press, there's consumers, particularly in some societies more than others. And a lot of companies react by saying, look, we don't really want to do anything to do with fossil fuel. We're not going to lend to fossil fuel companies, not because regulation requires it, not because, you know, it's high risk on our balance sheet, simply because we can't be bothered, simply because our shareholders don't like it. You know what? We're out of this business. And so the question then arises, maybe regulators should do absolutely nothing because the market would bring this outcome about, right? But, and this may be controversial, this may not be where you want to be. For an orderly climate transition, which will take many years, right? We will need fossil fuels for a while. We need to phase them out. We need to combine them with renewables, but we cannot just stop. That will not work. And so, I know that the number of central banks begin to worry whether their supervised entities, their banks, are pulling out of this too fast. Imagine that. A few years ago, we want them to pull out faster. Now we're saying, hang on, that may be too fast. Maybe in the next 10 years, we want to maintain a reasonable declining or reasonable flow of investment in these, because we need them to have an orderly climate transition, right? So it cuts both ways. I don't know which of the two questions you were asking. I think the former, but maybe
actually the second one as well.
So there, I think the regulators may have a role to play in ensuring that whatever happens, you know, you don't get a sudden shift of financial flows that could be destabilizing for the broader economy. But again, they will not do this without coordination with the policymakers, because they will be left on not only being the only game in town, but playing a game that doesn't look very good to the press or to the green campaigners. Right? So they don't want to be saying we need fossil fuel investments. What they would want, I'm guessing, is they would want to have a long-term transition plan by the government, and then they can support it. And in that context of that plan, ensure that the financial flows go to where they're supposed to go, including, if necessary, to fossil fuels for a while. Is that kind of
yeah, nonsense. I guess what you're saying from the second point is just making sure that you know, concentration of assets and green versus brown is kind of like managed in a phased.
Exactly. It should not happen. Obviously, it should happen, but it should not happen too fast either. Right.
Perhaps just one follow-up question. One thing that we see in practice is that you go to participate at the G20, you go to participate at the IMF or the Financial Stability Forum, you get your binder, you make your presentation on how important it is to include climate in financial risk management, to deliver your speech. But then when you go back to your priorities at your country, you get a series of pressures in terms of issues such as, you know, we're in the context of a high interest rates, what about liquidity in our traditional financial system, what about inflation, what about, you know, how have you seen this playing out in reality? You know, vis-a-vis going to a meeting and saying this is important and we really need to, you know, do something about this, but then going back with the, you know, timelines and political, you know, deadlines that you really need to take care of, and at the same time not being able to really incorporate that whole vision in terms of the mainstream risk assessment and the mainstream priorities.
Yeah. So, okay, so you're asking a difficult question. I would say two things. First, it was a lot easier to talk about climate risk in 2015-16, right? The world was looking a lot better and the task for central banks and regulators looked a lot easier. We were emerging from the Great Recession, the system was reasonably stable, inflation was low and had been low for a while. Okay, the questions were about productivity growth and stuff like that, but this was not central bank territory. So okay, we can afford, so to speak, to look at other issues where we might be useful. The world today looks very different, particularly for central banks, given the inflation resurgence. And this is why I said earlier, context is everything. So that's one thing. It is more difficult now to address issues like this, not because they're not important, but because they have to fight for priority and for priority within the other mandates that we as a society have given to central banks and regulators. So that's number one. Number two, and relatedly, if you're a regulator, it's easier to incorporate climate considerations into your existing framework. It's easier to prioritize it if you need to incorporate it in your framework. It's not controversial that if there is climate-related risk, banks should take it into account and you have the tools to make them do it. So that's not controversial. That's a risk among many others, and you do your job. What is much more difficult is if you want, or you have the ambition as a regulator, or if you feel the pressure from society or the press to go beyond that. If you want to go, or if you're forced to go outside your frame, because then questions of prioritization of policy goals will become very immediate, especially if you have to fight inflation, especially if your financial system or some sectors of it seem to be overheating, especially if you worry about financial system, then it gets messy, right? But if you can, and I think central banks are earnestly trying to do it, if you can incorporate it into your existing framework, then it's fine. Then it's just a risk among many others. Now, to all of us saying, oh, it's just a risk among many others may sound wrong, right? Because it's a much more serious risk. But again, you're a regulator. You're not a policymaker, you're not a government, right? You're a regulator, you're looking at a narrow sliver of reality, and you're accountable and responsible for that. So from that narrow perspective, it's just a risk like any other.
I think there's...
I've exhausted them.
Yeah.
So you just said it's just a risk like any other, but I feel like with financial risk in some ways is always a possibility of like rebound in some way, of building things back up. With the environment, with the climate, it hits a point where...
Sorry, say that again. Lower it because it's difficult to understand.
You, so with other risks, a lot of other risks, we can kind of rebuild after these risks. We can kind of...
Yes.
Like people always say, don't worry about the stock market. It like will go down, but it will rebound again later. We can't do that with the, yeah. So it's not a risk just like any other. We're already seeing it. Well, we're getting these feedback loops that are getting worse and worse. So shouldn't regulators be taking that into account? It feels like now they're acting like, oh, it's still looking at this 3 to 5 year time horizon when they should be looking at 30 to 50 year.
Yes,
because.
Yeah. So, okay. So on that last point, I hope it was clear, regulators did try to look over 30 to 50, in fact, 80 year horizon in the stress test. It didn't work out very well because of the limitations of the toolkit that we have today. Not because they made a mistake, but simply the tools that we have are not well suited for looking 30 to 50 years out. So they did not fail to do this. They just, the experience was mixed, right? But on the more fundamental question that you asked, you know, is it really fair to treat this like any other risk? I think that's a very good question. It's exactly spot on. It's a risk that can have potentially catastrophic consequences, whereas no other risk that I can think of can. It can have very severe in case of a deep crisis, but really, we live, right? So, but then I think the relevant question is, and the question that we should all ask ourselves is fine, but is financial regulation really the tool to deal with a catastrophic risk such as this? Probably not. Financial regulation has a role to play, there's no doubt about this, but it is probably a supporting role to other more central, more effective interventions. And I think what I'm concerned about, and I'm very happy not to be a central bank governor or regulator having to say this in public, but what I'm concerned about is that the people are afraid to come out and say, look, our role is a supporting role, our role is a secondary role for this particular case. Right? Because they don't want to be caught on the wrong side of a Twitter storm or a media criticism. But I really believe this is reality. We cannot use financial regulation to mitigate climate change. We have to use other tools. And then once we use the other tools, financial regulation can complement, amplify, and enhance the effectiveness. Does that answer your question? Not satisfactory.
No, because I feel like all we hear from institutions is this collective action problem waiting for somebody else to blink first and make some kind of radical change or statement and say everyone's waiting for someone else to do something.
Right, yes, you're right, but not everyone is equally responsible, not everyone is equally well equipped to deal with this. So I would worry more about governments waiting for somebody else to act than for regulators waiting for the governments to act. But you're right, this is a real problem that you put your finger on, and we're all responsible for this. I don't think we're all equally responsible. That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you. Well, thank you for the presentation. It has been fascinating, and as I said, a very pertinent topic at this moment in time, and one that all of the students at UMC are quite interested in. Thank you, Dimitri.
Thank you.
Thank you to you all, and see you in the next course.
Thank you.